Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're broadcasting from Zion Canyon Mesa. Great to be here once again in Springdale. And we have events, of course, this evening. We've got a reminder to folks, we'll be broadcasting Behind the Headlines tomorrow from St. George. But today, very pleased to welcome in to the program for the hour, Corey Flintoff. He's a former NPR foreign correspondent whose assignments included Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Haiti, Ukraine, and Russia. He was NPR Southeast Asia Bureau Chief and Moscow Bureau Chief, born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska, now lives in Maryland. We're going to talk about current restrictions on reporting the war in Iran, the effects of that. Some of Corey Flintoff's experiences being embedded with troops. We'll talk about the decline of international reporting in general. And during this hour, we'll get into talking about the Ukraine-Russia war, its effects on both Ukraine and Russia today. So Corey Flintoff, thanks for joining me.
It's my very great pleasure to be back with you, Tom.
So great to be with you again, and thanks for coming out to the beautiful Red Rock country here.
It is stunningly beautiful here.
Let's start with a little bit of your background. I know your background pretty good, but some of our listeners may not be as familiar with you. You started in Alaska, which is your home state.
Right. Yes. I started at a small station in southwestern Alaska in a town called Bethel, which has public radio, of course, is very important in states like Alaska and Utah, where there's large distances involved. You know, there's a communities can be fairly remote, and it's a way of linking together all these various communities and groups of people throughout the state. There are 17 public radio stations in Alaska, all usually in very small areas, but all very important, you know, as local sources of news and community issues and that kind of thing. So that was a great introduction to public radio for me. And I see that it works very much the same way in Utah.
Yeah. By the way, I don't know if you keep in touch with anybody in Alaska in those small stations. I know some of the, especially the smaller stations, really being hit with the loss of CPB funding.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry.
I was asking you if you know of any stations back in Alaska that have been hit by the loss of funding.
Yes, I would say that virtually all of them, because as I say, they're typically small communities. They're much more remote than most Americans are familiar with. I mean, the distances are enormous, and there's not a highway system to link them. So, you know, these communities typically don't have a lot of local resources to pay for public broadcasting. They've received support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the loss of that support is really kind of devastating.
So how did you go from Alaska, you had the public radio there, to making the show, the NPR?
Well, I had a chance to go to Washington. At the time, they had a program for people from local public radio stations to go work for a couple of weeks at the network and get a sense of how the whole system worked. And so I got to do that. And in the course of it, I got a job offer and came to Washington as a newscaster, which I was for years. I was the top of the hour newscaster for the All Things Considered program. It was a lot of fun and a good chance to be at home in the mornings. I worked in the afternoons and evenings, be at home in the mornings so I could be with my daughter as she was growing up.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Then how did you get to, you became international correspondent and bureau chief?
Yeah, well, I volunteered. You know,
you volunteered.
What happens to you when you volunteer. And the first time I volunteered was for coverage in Haiti. Lulu Garcia Navarro, my colleague, person who now works for the New York Times, was the correspondent who covered Mexico and the Caribbean. And she, for some reason, I don't even remember what it was not able to make her usual visit to Haiti, in this case, to cover the elections in 2006. That was a very fraught election and a very exciting time to be there. And I got to Haiti, and it was like a burst of color. It was like The Wizard of Oz. You know, it starts out in black and white, and suddenly you're in Oz, and it's in brilliant Technicolor. Well, Haiti is a Technicolor place all the time. It's a wonderful, vibrant culture, but a terrible political situation. Mm. And so I went down there to cover that, and I discovered, you know, I think what I really wanted to do all along, which was to cover foreign issues and people in other cultures.
You were Moscow bureau chief. What years? What time?
That was from 2012 to 2016. So mm-hmm. some of the most interesting and devastating events in Russian history. Of course, that was the seizure of Crimea. That was the Russian incursions into eastern Ukraine, Donbass and Luhansk, and a lot of. The beginning, in fact, of the Ukraine war as we know it today, that all took place from 2014 on.
Mm. Of course, we know Russian journalists being killed. Did you feel safe?
I didn't feel threatened. I felt harassed in Russia, but never physically threatened in any way.
Mm. Yeah. Well, let's talk about coverage of wars. In the past, there's always been a provision for correspondence, for news reporting from the scene. This war in Iran, no such provision.
Exactly. And I mean, that's a very disturbing thing. You know, if you look at our coverage, the coverage of the Iran war that we're seeing, it's almost always a matter of press conferences from Defense Secretary Hegseth and General Kane. It's a very limited window into what's going on in the Iran conflict. We have something over 50,000 American troops, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in the theater of war, and we know almost nothing about what that war feels like to them. When I was assigned to cover Iraq and Afghanistan, for instance, I'd go over for a month or so at a time, and it was expected that at least I'd spend at least a week of every one of those assignments embedded with American troops. And for me, it was a window into what life is like for the average American soldier. You know, and I think that's tremendously important. You know, embedding with American troops is not really about telling what the war is about or what the strategy is about or anything like that. It's about telling what life is like for our American troops, the men and women that actually go out there and make the sacrifices and risk their lives. And we're not finding out about that in this war. We know nothing about that.
Yeah, there's you know, the famous fog of war, but that extends now to us. We don't know much of what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as an example, the Washington Post just did an analysis of satellite imagery that's commercially available because the Pentagon, of course, has blocked some companies from releasing their satellite imagery of the Middle East. But there's still commercial imagery that's available. And the Post did an analysis of images from these satellites and found that there's something like 228 American targets had been hit by Iranian missiles or drones. I mean, they're things as small as a vehicle and some of them as large as a base. But the Pentagon is not telling us about these things. In fact, you know, what we get is invective from Secretary of War Hegseth when reporters ask him too many questions. So, you know, I think that's a really dangerous thing for the American people. I mean, you know, leadership is all about, leadership in war especially, is all about letting the American people know why this conflict is taking place, what the stakes are, what the strategy is, and what the end game is. And I'm afraid we're not finding that out.
I guess to that point, usually the briefings by Secretary Hegseth have to do with tonnage and bombs and armaments. Never anything to do, or usually very seldom anything to do with strategy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I learned a lot of things in my embeds with American troops. I was with primarily with Army units and with Marines in Afghanistan. And I learned a lot of things. And one of it is what war can look like, or at least what a combat patrol can look like from the eyes of an American soldier. One thing I discovered was, for instance, when you get into a military vehicle and you go on patrol through an area of Iraq, say, looking through the windows of a Humvee gives you a very different idea of what's going on. At that time, there was a lot of danger from roadside bombs. And, you know, you look out the window of a Humvee and you see a man on a street corner with a cell phone to his ear, and you begin to suspect that that person is somehow locating you or warning, setting up an ambush in advance. You know, so it's a very different view of what life is like. You know, as a reporter on the street, and I, you know, at various times in Iraq, I was able to just travel around rather normally. You know, you get a completely different view. That man with the cell phone is just a man with a cell phone. So, you know, troops feel themselves under threat in a lot of different ways. You know, the situation is stressful in a lot of different ways that we don't understand from this distance. And I imagine that's exactly what's going on with all these people who are deployed in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, I guess there's that component of it as well, isn't there? The troops would like us to, maybe like us to know what they're going through.
Yes, I, you know, on all my embeds, I felt welcomed by the troops that I was with and with the commanders that I was with. They knew that I wasn't always going to report, you know, in a rosy way about what conditions were like, but they still welcomed my presence in the presence of my colleagues. Mm. So it's not at the troop level that we're not getting information. It's at the leadership level. Mm.
I want to have us talk just a little bit about your topic tonight at our special event. If you're in the Southern Utah area, I invite you to go to upr.org and come out to our event at the Bitten Spur in Springdale. Corey Flintoff will be headlining that event. And, of course, the topic for tonight is fake news, how media consolidation endangers our democracy. I don't want to give away the whole conversation, but a little bit of a taste of it right now. And maybe to get us into that, Secretary Hegseth has famously asked any press covering the Pentagon to sign a disclaimer, right? And so some of the major outlets don't have anybody at the Pentagon right now. They still have sources. They still report. But it makes it harder.
Yeah, actually, the thing that people were required to sign on to was the idea that they would not report anything that hadn't been previously vetted by the by the Pentagon. And of course, I mean, that's absolutely inimical to anything that that journalists normally do. And a lot of people simply walked out. Now the Pentagon has been ordered to reinstate people, but they're putting them in a separate building now, preventing them from having the normal movement around the Pentagon that Pentagon reporters used to have. So I think that's clearly a form of censorship, and you can call it national security if you like, but I think national security really demands a lot more transparency about what our Defense Department or Department of War, as Hegseth likes to call it, is doing.
Mm. So tonight you're going to talk about media consolidation. You sent over some stats. Committee to Protect Journalists reports in 1983, 90% of all American media outlets were owned by 50 different companies. Now six corporations control almost all of the
outlets. We know all their names. I don't know if I can recite them off the top of my head, but I mean, we've got Walt Disney Company. We've got Paramount, Skydance. We've got Warner Brothers, Amazon, Sony. I think I'm missing one. But anyway, Yeah, I mean, these are the major corporations that now control almost all media in the country. And we're in the midst of a big merger right now. It's taking place. It was formally approved by the shareholders just last month. It's the Paramount Skydance Warner Brothers Discovery merger, $111 billion deal that's going to unite companies that control both CNN and CBS. So these outlets, news organizations that used to be that are big competitors are now going to be under the same umbrella. Is that good for competition? I don't think so.
Other complicating factor is the government has a hand in mergers.
Absolutely.
Ruling on antitrust, right?
Right. The mergers are controlled by the Federal Communications Commission and the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. To the degree that those agencies are controlled by the administration, that means government control and government pressure on these kinds of business decisions. I don't think that's a good thing either. You know, if the Department of Justice and the FCC were totally independent agencies, as they are congressionally and constitutionally required to be, then I wouldn't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But for instance, the FCC chairman, Brendan Carr, has twice threatened the licenses of ABC over, as you'll recall, these Jimmy Kimmel jokes about President Trump. And in one case, it was the Charlie Kirk assassination. Not very tasteful jokes, but nonetheless, nothing that you should threaten somebody's broadcast license over.
Yeah.
So we're in a period of substantial government pressure on broadcasting, and it's not a good thing for our democracy.
One more thing on this, and we'll leave the rest of that discussion to this evening. So when you were reporting for NPR, I assume you had supportive higher-ups at NPR for...
Yes, absolutely.
Investigative reporting.
Right. We felt protected by our governance. And you know that NPR is governed by a board that's composed of our public radio station managers. You know, so we are answerable to stations and organizations like UPR. We've always felt that our board had our backs and our CEO had our backs, and that's incredibly important.
Yeah. I don't want to get too hyperbolic here, and, we'll do a pause between these two topics. I'm going to leap to Russia, for example, authoritarian regime, government murdering journalists, that'll put a chill. But this kind of consolidation also is a form of control of,
one of the reasons media. That I'm so concerned about media consolidation in the United States is that when I was the correspondent in Russia, I saw exactly this kind of thing happening. When my wife and I first got to Moscow, we saw the media landscape there and we thought, this is really quite diverse. You know, you have some state-controlled broadcasting channels, but you have a lot of independent channels, a lot of independent newspapers and radio stations and everything. It seemed like a very diverse media landscape. But we gradually realized that wherever you turned, whether it was to a news station or a talk station, a reality show, television, sports, pop music, all these different sources tended to have exactly the same editorial stance, and that was the voice of the Russian government. And what had happened, and it happened prior to the time that I was there, but also during the time that we were there, was that the Putin government took control of the state-owned media outlets. But Putin's cronies, the oligarchs who depend on him and are his allies, bought up the independent news sources, bought up the other radio and television stations, and took control of them. So the result was that everybody in Russia now speaks with the same government flavored voice. You know, so you have to ask yourself, is that happening in this country? A billionaire like Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post. The editorial stance of the Washington Post has changed by about 180 degrees. It's now a full-voiced, free market, Republican-oriented media organ, like very much like the Wall Street Journal, for instance. So, David Ellison, whose father is Larry Ellison, is the billionaire owner of Oracle, now owns Paramount Skydance and is in the process of taking over Warner Brothers. An ally of the Trump administration. So, I mean, we're seeing, you know, these are the equivalent of the oligarchs in Russia, and very much the same thing seems to be happening here.
Let's leave that topic and the rest of it for this evening. Again, the Bit and Spur tonight in Springdale. You can come out and support it, be a fundraiser for UPR and for the Corey Flintoff Student Internship Fund.
Yes.
Which is a great thing.
Something that's very, very close to my heart.
Yeah. Let's take a break. We're talking with former NPR foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff on the program today. When we come back, we'll talk about the state of foreign reporting, which has declined over time. And we'll get into talking about Ukraine and Russia, the war, more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are at Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. My guest for the hour is former NPR foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff. He's headlining an event for UPR this evening at the Bit and Spur in Springdale. You go to upr.org, learn more about that. It's a fundraiser for, at least in part, for the Corey Flintoff Student Internship Fund. So that's a wonderful thing. I want to talk about the state of international reporting. I imagine you have a finger on the pulse there, being a former international correspondent. Mm-hmm. What's the state of international reporting?
Well, it's difficult right now. We talked a little bit about media consolidation. As media organizations consolidate or are eliminated from the landscape, that cuts down on foreign reporting. NPR is doing its best. In fact, my former colleagues at NPR are still out there reporting from their various posts around the world. But with the loss of funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that makes things a lot tougher. I don't know if people realize that even with a pretty frugal organization like NPR, foreign reporting is just terribly expensive. To maintain a bureau in New Delhi or Moscow is very costly. It requires some support staff, and translators and fixers and drivers, and the kind of people who are just essential to getting reporters to where they need to be. They have to be decently paid and protected. So all those costs make it much more difficult to do the kind of foreign reporting that we need to do. I have former NPR reporters and producers who are now working for other news organizations who are seeing something of the same thing. The Washington Post has cut back on its foreign reporting. The New York Times has cut back. It's not so noticeable because these organizations tend to fill in with, for instance, reports from the Associated Press. And so the sense is that you're still getting foreign news. But in fact, it's not from the same reporters and the same organizations that we normally count on. Mm. This is not good. America, being the big country that it is, tends to be a little bit parochial. We are so big, our population is so big, that you can live your entire life in the United States and not have a good sense of what's going on in the rest of the world. You kind of don't need it until war breaks out or there's a catastrophic natural disaster or something. But, you know, what it helps us to have that day-to-day reporting from other countries that lets us know what's going on in the human community all around the world rather than just our local communities. Terribly important. And it's actually, I think, diminishing.
So we just leave it all to BBC these days? Is that
Well, I mean, the BBC is still important.
You know? And I might point out BBC is publicly funded.
Yes.
So, you know, draw what conclusions you may from that.
Absolutely right. You know, I think one of the things that works against the kind of media monopolies that we just talked about are publicly funded but editorially independent organizations like the BBC and NPR. You know, the American public deserves to have an independent news source that's not controlled by the government but is funded by taxpayer dollars. And as we know, NPR, for instance, is not heavily funded by American taxpayer dollars. It's a very, very small percentage, and that's all mostly funded by contracts and things like that. Where the funding is important is at the individual radio stations and regional radio stations that got their funding from CPB. Mm-hmm. You know, without that independent media source, then these sort of media consolidation and commercialized media and politicized medias have a lot more sway. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Now, if I'm looking for news, things I'm interested in, the Iran war, the Ukraine war, other things, I can find all manner of reports and podcasts on YouTube and other places. The problem that I run into is I don't know, you know, it's not independently vetted for me in a place like NPR or mm-hmm. New York Times. I guess that's the problem. Unless you can independently verify that whoever you're watching has good information.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And the argument that people who say that media consolidation is not a problem is they say, well, look around. You know, people have all these different sources of information. They have podcasts, they have newsletters, they have all these different sources that didn't exist before when broadcasting was sort of dominated by the big three television networks, for instance. But if you look at all these, the whole purpose of podcasting is a niche audience. Podcasters aim for a relatively small audience, mostly that's all self-selected, that tend to have the same ideological opinions and that sort of thing. So you don't get a big, diverse stretch of opinion and information that you do with what used to be the commercial television networks and with organizations like NPR and PBS.
Anything else you'd like to say on international reporting? Then we'll take a break and head to Ukraine.
I'm sorry?
Anything else you'd like to say about international reporting?
I would say that for people, for us who are now consumers, look carefully and see what your source is. You know, make sure that it's a credible source, and make sure it's a source that audience size is important, because if it's a large and diverse audience, you know that your information organization, your media organization has to be answerable to a large and diverse audience. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of judging the credibility of your news organization.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to have Corey check in on the Ukraine war, Russia-Ukraine war. He was Moscow bureau chief, of course, and kept up attention. And I guess
I can't help but stay attuned to it.
Yeah. We're talking with former NPR foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff. More following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Instead of in studio, I am at the beautiful Zion Canyon Mesa in beautiful Springdale.
There's no question about it.
We're just enjoying this a lot, and thanks to the good folks at Zion Canyon Mesa. I'm talking this hour with former NPR foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff. He is in town to headline an event tonight for UPR. Part of what we're raising money for tonight is the Corey Flintoff Student Internship Fund. You don't have to come to the event to give to that. Go to upr.org to
Absolutely don't. And it's the one of the best causes I know, because it supports the future of journalism.
Certainly true. Corey Flintoff, his assignments included Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Haiti, Ukraine, and Russia. He was an NPR Southeast Asia Bureau Chief and Moscow Bureau Chief. And I want to concentrate on the Ukraine and Russia. You were reported from Ukraine and Russia.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And a great deal from Ukraine after the seizure of Crimea and the whole beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war.
So let's check in with that. Of course, this goes 4 years, is it? It's been 3 or 4 years. I can't remember when it started.
It was 4 years in Russia.
No, I mean since the war started.
I mean, because really, if you think about it, the war started in 2014.
That's true.
With it's just the seizure of Crimea and the Russian, I call it, and I think from as an eyewitness, I call it the Russian subversion of eastern Ukraine in Donbass and Luhansk.
Mm-hmm. So a decade plus.
Yeah,
so what we're looking at. In preparation for this program, you kind of focused on Vladimir Putin's Victory Day. I put celebration in quotes this time. It was a little subdued this time.
I always keep an eye on Victory Day, and people will know it's actually May 9th. And it commemorates the Russian or the Soviet victory in what Russians know as the Great Patriotic War, World War II. And Vladimir Putin has used the celebrations on Victory Day as a way of militarizing and nationalizing Russian patriotism. Russians are very patriotic about World War II because they suffered terrible losses. 20 million people or more, I mean, in the course of World War II, in the course of defeating the Germans. Every Russian family has a story of someone who died in that conflict. So it's very important. And Putin has, over the years, gradually sort of militarized the celebration. We know it as what you see on television. It's this tremendous parade in Red Square. You see, you know, ballistic missiles and, you know, various kinds of war machines, tanks and so forth, and thousands of troops marching in unison. You know, it's a very impressive thing. I covered four of them directly. But each time, more and more, it's a means of sort of militarizing the society. And those celebrations have gotten bigger and more expansive. There are reenactments in the public parks in Moscow, and people dress up in World War II cosplay and that sort of thing. Little kids are dressed up in World War II style uniforms, flags all over the place. You know, it's quite a thing. But this year, well, last year, I should say, was a big one. And the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, was present. This year, it was a much, much cut down celebration. Almost no military vehicles, relatively few troops, no foreign leaders except for the ones that are the very direct allies of Putin, you know, from Belarus, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, but, you know, no foreign leaders from farther afield than that. And the reason is that the Russians were fearful that this whole display could have been interrupted by Ukrainian drones and missiles. And it's a sign, really, that, you know, Russia now finds itself much more vulnerable to Ukrainian attacks than they have in the past. There are rumors from the Kremlin that Putin himself is much more fearful about his personal safety, because now, as we know, Ukrainian drones have hit targets in and around Moscow. They've hit a lot of Russia's oil refining capacity, sometimes thousands of kilometers within Russian territory. That's something that the Russians weren't exactly expecting. So the tide of the war hasn't exactly turned. They say that Russian troops are still slowly but surely grindingly gaining territory in eastern Ukraine at the rate of, I don't know, 5 square kilometers a month or something like that, at a terrible, terrible cost in human lives. This month's victory celebration coincided with a report that was released by two independent Russian news organizations, and they're exile news organizations from outside the country now. But they did an analysis concluding that Russia so far has had 352,000 soldiers killed in the course of the last 4 years of this war. You know, in the ratio of killed to wounded in this conflict is very high. It's about 1 in 3, meaning that more than 1 million Russian soldiers have been either killed or injured in this conflict. Now, Russia has a population of about 140 some million people. And that tells you that many, many families throughout Russia have now experienced a direct casualty in this war. And many, many others know someone who's experienced a direct casualty. And that has a lot of effect on public opinion, a lot of exhaustion in the war.
I guess a testament to what a repressive regime can do. Hold on, but at a certain point, is there a breaking point with regard to Putin's power?
You know, it's very hard to say. For one thing, the Russian population is resilient in the sense that they're used to putting up with sacrifice. And so, you know, when the economy is affected by the war, and it has been seriously affected, when there are personal casualties that people know about. Some of the military towns in Russia, especially places like Pskov and Khabarovsk that have big military installations, also now have big military cemeteries. So people see the costs of the war every day. But that population is also inured to a certain amount of sacrifice. And it goes back to World War II, where people experience such great suffering and yet manage to emerge from it victorious. You know, people are told constantly that that's what happens. You have to put up with the terrible sacrifices and terrible misery, but you will eventually succeed. And I think that's what the propaganda is tending to in Russia, and that's what people are faced with.
We're seeing lately, of course, Russia learning this lesson, relearning it in Ukraine. The U.S. is relearning a lesson in Iran about asymmetric warfare, that a lesser power can be successful.
Absolutely.
Drone warfare has changed the game. What do you think the most likely outcome of the Ukraine war will be right now?
You know, it's difficult to say because it is such a centralized government with decisions in the hands basically of one person or in a very small coterie of people who are rather isolated both from their own population and from the effects of the war. You know, while the Russian population suffers from, you know, they're very close to a recession. That's not felt by the oligarchs and the inner circle of the Kremlin. And Putin himself, he's now 73 years old. He's been in power for, I guess, 20. Well, he's been in power since 2000, so 26 years. I think that at one point, Putin thought that he was going to establish a legacy as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Russian leader, you know, the equivalent of a very powerful czar. He thought he was going to reunite much of the Soviet Union, bring it back under Russian influence. You know, he literally saw this as his legacy. And I think he still does. I think that's why he's very, very resistant to making any kind of compromise that would end this war. And I think that he, for one thing, Russian leaders from the czars through Stalin, right up to Putin, have been very willing to sacrifice their own people. And that seems to be Putin, too. I mean, he's willing to see any number of troops die in order to achieve what's become a very limited goal now, control of eastern and southeastern Ukraine. So I'm not very optimistic about a solution to this. You know, it may be that there can still be some kind of face-saving compromise that would allow him to step away. But the Ukrainians have suffered so greatly and so much loss that I don't think they can accept very much of a compromise either. And the Ukrainians are feeling stronger. The Ukrainians over the last 4 years have built a very strong defense industry, one that other countries are looking to, especially in drone warfare. You know, so the Ukrainians have many reasons for hope and many reasons to hold on. So this is not a good outcome. I mean, this war could grind on God knows how long.
I was just going to ask you, so quite a bit longer.
So I'm afraid
predicting.
So.
Yeah. No, the U.S. seems to be, you know, Trump is on again, off again in terms of offering support. It seems like the Europeans might have to be the major supporters of Ukraine.
Right. I think that's the case. I'm always a little bit surprised. I suppose I shouldn't be that President Trump is so pro-Russian in this conflict and always has been. You know, when there seems to be no particular reason for it, you know, that he has, I don't know what he has to gain from Russia, you know, so the United States support for this conflict for Ukraine has dropped. We are now in the situation where European powers are buying American weapons that they are then supplying to Ukraine. But the war in Iran, of course, has changed that calculus a great deal because the United States has burned up so much weaponry in the first assault on Iran that our supplies are now low, and European leaders are who have already pre-ordered American weapons are finding that they're not getting those weapons delivered. So that's not a good sign as far as Ukraine is concerned. You know, Ukraine seems to realize, President Zelensky seems to realize that increasingly he's going to be on his own and he's going to have to rely on his own industry to produce the weapons he needs.
Well, we'll leave it there. Out of time. A great discussion. We've been talking with Corey Flinta, former NPR foreign correspondent, former Moscow bureau chief. He's in town in Springdale. We're broadcasting from Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale.
Yeah, his mind is blown by the scenery.
Yes. Yes. That was great to see you looking at the Red Rocks here this morning. And of course, Corey will headline the event at the Bitten Spur in Springdale tonight, a fundraiser for UPR and for the Corey Flintoff UPR Student Internship Fund. Go to upr.org to find out more about those. Corey Flintoff, thank you so much.
It's an absolute pleasure, Tom. It's really great to be with you.
Always great to see you, and thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures, Skywatcher Leo T. As we look up and over, after sunset, grab the binoculars. And after dark, the moon is our tour guide. For some difficult-to-spot planets this month, Luna has some especially close encounters with several stars as well. It teams up with Saturn and Mars in the dawn sky early in the month, along with Neptune, which is too faint to see with the naked eye alone. The moon comes close to Mercury as well, but it's a little tricky to spot. As the moon continues its tour, it gets especially close to Antares, the blinking bright orange heart of the Scorpion, near month's end in twinkly Scorpius. The summer triangle begins to climb into the evening sky now, along with Libra, the balance scales, and Leo, the lion, plunges headfirst into the southwestern horizon. Also sailing southwest on April 29, 1947, Kon-Tiki, a six-man expedition, set sail from Peru, across the Pacific Ocean on a 101-day journey to the Polynesian Islands. Now, I don't know about you, but like the Polynesians, sailing takes me away to where I'm going, and we see clouds, altocumulus, cirrus, stratocirrus, sometimes long streaks of white feathery streaks across the entire blue sky from the mountains to the west, to the mountains in the east, and sailing on the ocean, we may see nacreous cloud. Nacreous clouds are a rare sight known for their iridescent colors. Forms in very cold conditions at high altitudes. For nacreous clouds to form, the air must be colder than about minus 121 degrees Fahrenheit, or that's 85 degrees Celsius. Unlike most of the clouds which form in the first layer of the Earth's atmosphere, nacreous clouds form in the stratosphere, Earth's second atmospheric layer. Nacreous clouds are found during the winter in high latitude areas, including the Arctic, Scotland, Scandinavia, and Alaska. They sometimes form over other areas of northern Europe, but are most common in Antarctica. Some nacreous clouds are wave clouds, which often form near mountain ranges. In some places, nacreous clouds are so brilliantly colorful and unusual that they are sometimes confused with the beautiful aurora borealis or northern lights. Look at the Skywatcher Leo T. Facebook page for amazing photos of this unique iridescent cloud formation. And speaking of spaceflight, it was on May 5th, 1961, that astronaut Alan B. Shepard launched for a 15-minute suborbital flight aboard Freedom 7 in a one-person Mercury capsule, NASA's first manned flight. And in a totally unrelated but relevant historical note of interest, in May of 1945, in the only fatal attack of its kind during World War II, a Japanese balloon bomb exploded on Gearhart Mountain in Oregon, killing the wife of a minister and five children. Denmark and the Netherlands were liberated, as well as German surrender went into effect. It's One Sky, Many Cultures, and since we've been discussing interesting clouds, in Australia and New Zealand and other cultures, constellations include dark clouds in the Milky Way. Aboriginal Australians give the name Dreamtime to the era when ancestral figures created our present world they call their tales, dreaming stories, and believe that these stories give meaning to special places and creatures that are still with us, like the emu in the sky. Dreamtime stories like the one of the emu in the sky are among the most cherished. The Australian celestial emu stretches over a quarter of the southern sky from the head of the beast in the dark spot called the coal sack through the Southern Cross, then across the dense dark region of the Milky Way to Scorpius, which outlines the body, and Sagittarius, where a bright star cloud represents the eggs it sits on. The seasonal movement of the emu in the sky animates the Dreamtime myth. Being close to the south celestial pole, the emu's head is visible from Australia every night. But the entirety of the big bird doesn't appear until April and May. That's when people say it runs across the sky, in concert with the mating season among emus when the females frantically chase the males. Make up your own constellations and stories and look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.